I dreamt a dream
Hello, my name is Kate Mildenhall. I'm a writer and co-host of the First Time podcast, and I am thrilled to be your host for this podcast series for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival. It's called I Didn't Plan It That Way, and it's conversations about failed ideas, misguided moments, and the books that stayed in the bottom drawer. Over five episodes, I'll talk to five guests of the festival: Meg Mason, Rick Morton, Sally Hepworth, Jesse Tu, and Michael Veitch, about their greatest failures and whether or not they learned anything from them at all. Do join myself, my guests, and the fabulous lineup of writers and thinkers for the Yarra Valley Writers Festival in Warburton this July 16 to 18. Check out our show notes or search for Yarra Valley Writers Festival for tickets.
Lowlands away, my John.
Jesse Tu is a Sydney-based journalist and writer. She was born in Taiwan and emigrated to Australia in 1992 with her family. Tu trained as a classical violinist for more than 15 years. Failing to succeed as a professional musician, she taught music. She's taught at refugee camps in the Middle East, volunteered with AusAid in the Solomon Islands, travelled to complete residencies in the US, and now works as a journalist at Women's Agenda. She's won several poetry and writing awards, and her first book of poetry was released in 2018. Her best-selling and critically acclaimed debut novel is A Lonely Girl Is a Dangerous Thing, released in 2020. Jesse Tu, thank you so much for speaking with me.
I'm very happy to be here.
Jesse, I love that your own bio puts failure straight up front. I want to ask, when did you realise you were not going to be a professional musician, and what did that failure feel like?
I realised after spending several years auditioning for big orchestras and never succeeding in those auditions, because I was just, it's something about auditions that really exposed my weakness in technique and like the most sort of basic foundation that you require as a classical musician is like technique, good technique, especially when you're playing in an orchestra, right? But I just like somehow never exhibited that ability to hold my own whenever I went into an audition. Like you always had about 3, 4, 5, up to like 7 or 8 people in front of you just kind of assessing you in a way that felt really artificial, and it didn't feel like the way that I felt when I performed just for like a crowd where the people there were just trying to enjoy the music. But there's something about like the harsh adjudication and that kind of context of people judging you and assessing you and looking at your technique that I just was so not good at, or like it just exposed the worst of my ability, I guess. And so it was not a very nice feeling, I guess, when I realized I was never going to make it, because I just couldn't overcome that sort of, it felt really disabling. Like it felt like I wasn't just up to scratch with my basic technique.
How did you kind of make the decision to leave it behind you? Because that's a, you know, obviously you persisted for a while feeling shit. How did you make the decision?
I think I actually found a lot of joy in something else, and that made leaving that world very easy. And so I found teaching to be extremely fun when I was in my early 20s. So I did teaching alongside professional playing, and it just it was such a relief to be in the classroom and to not be judged the same way as when I was in the performance capacity. And so I think the comfort that I felt in the classroom and the sort of ease and the playfulness that I found myself surrounded in within, like, you know, young children made leaving that world of classical music very easy.
I'm interested in whether as you shifted to teaching, whether you were able to take your feelings of exposure and that kind of those moments that were so awful for you in auditions. Were you able to talk to your students about that, or I suppose prevent that happening in any way for them?
Yeah, I tried to kind of, I think I wasn't a very good teacher because I was so tough on technique, but because I myself didn't have that foundation, that very solid foundation. And so what happened was like I became very, very aggressive in trying to make my students see what I wasn't, you know. Yeah. So like I think if I look back, I probably was like one of those young, very strict teachers, and which, you know, if I was teaching today, I don't teach anymore, but if I did, I think I would change the way I taught in trying to just encourage kids to really enjoy what they do. I think that's first and foremost most important.
I remember as a young teacher just how high my expectations were of, you know, the students, and that I would go back now and just be like, I'm so sorry that I made you do everything I did.
I know, it's ridiculous. Like I can't believe how aggro I got. Just like if I said something one time, I actually just assumed and expected that the kid will remember, but they never did or rarely did.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, I've realized after years of teaching that if someone remembers what you say, that's actually like quite a miracle.
Yeah, that's a massive win. You should take that as a win. Jessie, in your novel, A Lonely Girl is a Dangerous Thing, Jenna is the protagonist. She's been a child prodigy, world famous violinist, and without spoiling too much, at a certain point, Jenna fails spectacularly and on purpose. I want to ask, have you ever failed on purpose?
Maybe at maybe at a job interview that I didn't really want, but no, I don't think I ever did that. I would never like waste anyone's time by doing that. But I don't think I've ever deliberately failed, because I've never attempted something that I knew I didn't really want.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about success. I noticed Christos Tsolkos gave your book a glowing endorsement, as it deserves, and he's written before about becoming greedy for success after The Slap kind of was a hit, and how he had to recognize this and kind of work around it. And in A Lonely Girl, Jenna says, and forgive me for reading your words back to you, but it's such a good quote. She's in a conversation and she says, "When I was younger, I saw success, but I couldn't really touch it. Then I got older and got closer to it, so close I could touch it, but then I began to see the cracks in this idea of success and I didn't like it. It's like the closer I got to it, the less I liked it, the uglier it appeared. The closer I got to this power, the less appeal it seemed to have." I want to ask about what your relationship with success is since Lonely Girl has come out. Has it changed the way you write? Has it changed the way you think about yourself as a writer? Are you feeling like there are expectations you now have to meet?
I think I've become more tough on myself, because I know that success can make you lazy. Like I'm very flattered by the reception that my first book has got, but it is my first book, and I never think that an author should be judged by their first work. I think that you are only as good as, I don't know, you know how people say you're only as good as your last book or whatever. I don't know. I'm still trying to think about what makes a good writer. I think I am just someone who is constantly, I think that I want to be someone, like I want to be a writer who is never completely satisfied with what she writes, because I don't want to be someone who's lazy and thinks that, oh, okay, my last book did well, so therefore I'm a good writer. No, never. Like I would never hold myself to sort of standards that I wouldn't hold to other people. So I think that the reception that I've got from the first book has only made me want to strive to do better, because I think I can do much better. I think that that first book was fortunate in that it was so unexpected, I guess, that so many people found it so resonating for them.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about how A Lonely Girl came about, how long it took you to write, how you got it published. Where did it come from, or where did it begin?
Began from a conversation I had with a writer, quite a well-known writer, who I had lunch with in New York City a few years ago. I was there for a workshop.
And I love that. I just have to stop you there, because it's such a great, you know, when I was having lunch in New York with a well-known writer, like whatever, just how I roll.
I didn't like that time was deeply lonely. And that's actually why I wrote the book, because I was there for a workshop that only lasted 3 weeks. But then I spent 2 weeks there trying to do my own stuff. And I guess during that period, I didn't know anyone in New York. And it was like very, very, like for those people who know, like who have been to New York and not known anyone, it's like the most lacerating feeling of loneliness and like agonizing sort of sense that you have no one sees you. And that's like really petrifying and like I remember just having, I wouldn't call it panic attacks because I don't think I know what they are, and I've never been diagnosed with having them, so I wouldn't, you know, throw that term around. But it was like this sense that I'd wake up in the morning and I would have the next 10, 12 hours of not knowing what to do because I didn't have anyone to meet up with. And I'm someone who's deeply, deeply unhappy when I'm just by myself. Like, I like having people around me all the time. And so I channeled all that fear and anxiety into writing this book, because that writer who I met up with was like, if you want to kind of establish yourself as a writer, come out with a novel first. And I had up to that point only written nonfiction because that's the voice that I felt most comfortable in. And so when he said that, I thought that maybe I would try fiction. And actually through writing fiction, I realized that I had more agency and freedom to write whatever it is I wanted to write it, because I could use it like through that character that, you know, ended up being Jenna.
Did it come out in a hit? It feels like it's a book that's full of kind of hunger and fire, I suppose. It feels like it might have come out really quickly. What was the process like for you?
Yeah, it was a big kind of dump on the page, so to speak. Yeah, it came out very quickly. The first draft was twice the length of the book, and it was very scrappy all over the place. And then through the next 2 years and with the help of extraordinarily talented geniuses and in the editors that I had at Allen Unwin, they were able to weave a story and make it into the book that people are holding today. So it's so amazing that only my name is on the cover, because like any writer, I mean, yourself included, would know a book is the product of many, many people.
So many people.
Yeah.
So many people and the conversations that you had. In terms of process, I was really interested to hear you speak to Ellen Cregan for Kill Your Darlings about your daily journaling. And you talk about it in response to her question about how you write sex so well and with so much detail. And I'm thinking, as I was listening to you, I'm thinking our journals are often a place, certainly for me, where we collate not only our own failings or perceived failings, I suppose, but those of others. How was it reading yours back? And do you normally read yours back? Is that just normal practice for you, or did you do it specifically to like pull out the gory bits for this book?
I did pull out gory bits from the book from like the last, I'd say, 5 years, when I saw a lot of my own behavior with men kind of really damaging. And so I wanted to go back and reread what I had done and like what I was feeling at the time, because like, I'm very, very honest in my journals. Like, I honestly just read. You know how some people kind of like write in a way that they expect other people to read it? I don't at all. I don't expect anyone else to read it. And so I'm very honest with myself on the page in the journal. And when I look back, I guess it's the same reaction that most people have, which is just like cringe.
Yeah.
You know,
do you write notes? Sometimes like I have another pen and I write a note to myself.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like you idiot.
Yes.
Yes. What were you doing?
Yeah. Or like, ha. Yeah. Or LOL.
Yeah. There's this sense in reading the book too, where you're like, oh, like with Jenna, you're like, oh God, that was fucked. And then, you know, like there's that sense. And then you're like, oh no, the app man, he's great. Like, I'm really enjoying him. He's great. But I feel like in some of the books that I'm reading now, in all those ones that you've been compared to as well, that there's this like litany of shit sex and how to make that better for people. How do we make it better?
I think there is no way of making it better, because people reach for sex because they feel shit about themselves, I guess. Mm. Some people. Mm. I mean, we all reach for sex for different reasons, but there are moments in our lives, especially with young people, where you don't really know who you are, or like for me it was like always feeling undesirable. And what you do when you feel undesirable is to reach for something that is like the most concrete, visceral, corporeal confirmation that someone wants you, that you're desirable, that your body is not this awful sick thing. And so you reach for sex because like the act of having someone touch you, there's just nothing like it, you know. There's nothing more powerful than someone having sex with you. So I don't know what point I'm trying to make.
No, it's just an interesting conversation. And I think it's I hope that that conversation continues in your next book, because I think you've started it and expressed it so well in Lonely Girl. And I think it's an important conversation. Was there catharsis in writing? So, I mean, some of them, there is ultimately, which is great and fulfilling. There's some great sex in the book, but there's also some really, really shit sex in the book for Jenna. Was it cathartic for you to write out some of what I imagine was drawn from life shit experiences into the book?
I think writing those, like you said, shit experiences for me, they were like shameful experiences. I think for me, that was just a way of valuing my own history and saying that it is okay what I did. You know, it's kind of like drawing a hand over my own like past self, like, and kind of patting myself on the shoulder, not in a praiseful way, but just saying, it's okay what you did. You don't have to feel bad. This is how it was. And the act of writing it down is kind of the act of valuing whatever experience you had in the past, negative or positive, and saying that it wasn't completely useless.
That's really interesting, because part of the conversations I've had with the other guests for this series about failure is also about that idea that, are there some failures or mistakes that we make that we just wish we hadn't, that there was nothing from them that we could learn, that the cost was actually too high.
As
you were going back through your journals, are there moments like that, or are you trying to kind of find, I suppose, the flesh of some learning out of each of them?
Yeah, I think it's very easy over time, because time is such a great sort of tutor, that over time you kind of just realize there's never like a distinct spark or a moment where you realize, oh, that was useful because of XYZ. You just come to learn that everything in the past has formed you in a way that is who you are today, which is like the best version of yourself. There is like one, the only thing that I regret, and I continue to regret, is this one relationship that I had with a guy who, it was very, very brief. And I still feel a lot of shame over it because of, you know, multiple reasons I won't go into. But that was like, I think I still feel shame over it because of the way in which that incident had left me feeling about myself. Mm. And I think that when women deprive themselves of their own needs to such a degree that I found myself depriving my own needs, it's just so not helpful. And I'm still like every day I feel like I'm trying to be stepping away from that old version of myself as far as I can, because it was just so like useless in my building my sense of self as a woman.
I'm glad that you used that example, because I want to talk about want and need. Jenna has an insatiable hunger. She tries to fill it in the book, both with sex and with fame, I suppose, or success. And there's a part in the book where her violin teacher asks her, "You were world famous, wasn't that enough?" And Jenna goes on to reply, "Of course it wasn't enough." And I suppose we know that the culture sees women wanting anything, let alone wanting too much, as a failing, and we can't really be seen to have any appetite at all. I've been struck recently by how often women, including myself, I think, apologize for being too much, too loud, too ambitious, too hungry. In an article, you're quoted as saying you have too much to say. I know a boy I loved once wrote a song with the line, "Too much is never enough for you." We do want, women do want, and we often want more. So how do we express and claim that wanting in a kind of culture that doesn't want us to want anything at all?
I mean, I guess we can, but the consequences are much more severe for us. And that's what I'm guessing that's what you're trying to say. Like, how can we live in a world that doesn't punish us negatively for wanting what we want and doing what we want? I guess like men need to change the way that they see us. I don't see any other way that the world can be a better place for women until, I guess, for me, like, gender completely should be erased. Women are still not seen as on par with men. Like, we're just not treated in the same way. And it's just because, you know, you and I, we live in female bodies, and there are assumptions that are eons and eons of in like as in a long historical precedence of that, that we, you and I, like before we entered this earth, had already been subscribed onto us, you know. So I have no idea how things are going to get better unless, like, we stop being seen as other.
Mm. Do you think it's changing? I feel like there's, I don't know whether it's my age, I'm about to turn 40, I don't know whether I'm like, I no longer give any fucks and I'm happy to say what I want now and I'm happy to show that, or I wonder whether I'm just part of what feels like, I suppose, a wave of women being able to say, I do want, this is what I want, and it's not what you think I want either. Do you think that's changing?
I think so. I have a lot of hope in younger men. Like, I have a lot of straight male friends who are like in their 20s and they're way, and I've like have also a history of dating younger men. They're like, and I realize it's because they're just way more woke. Like, they're way more able to see and comfortable seeing women as just like another human being rather than like a woman who I need to possess in a certain way sexually. I think it's a generational thing. I mean, I'm not saying there are no right-wing, you know, young men, there are, but it's just like it seems to be more of a norm these days that young men, the next generation of men, are learning that it's just not normal to treat women up in another way.
Mm. I'm interested too in the friendships Jenna has in the book and the ways in which she's sometimes hollowed out by them or she fails at them, and the ways in which she also seeks fulfillment in them. How do you see friendship as being kind of, I suppose, the antithesis or some kind of healing to that?
Oh, yeah.
Those sexual kinds of encounters that Jenna has?
I think every story I'll ever write hopefully will be centered around women relationships, be it friendship or sexual or any other emotional, psychological aspect. Because I know myself personally that female friendships have been the most fulfilling and deep relationships that I've had, like more than any other relationship I've had with a man. All my female friends have given me something that has like been so much more reliable and, I don't know, like another word for deep. Like, it's just like women get women. Like, I hate the fact that I'm straight because I think I'll always be giving something to the man that they don't necessarily deserve on the basis of their sex. But I can't help it. You know, I wish I could change my sexuality, but I can't, because I think that women just understand women on an elemental level. And women are just way more like compassionate generally, honestly. Like, they're much more loving and kind and,
before I move on, I wanted to ask a little bit more about your process too, because reading your book, reading Lonely Girl, and the kind of discipline that Jenna has in her practice, like to the point of crazy, you know, at times. And then I was thinking about you and the way that you might have had that musical discipline in your life and how then you approach it or drag it over to your writing. What does your writing discipline look like?
I don't really have a discipline, as in, like, I feel like a discipline is like a routine or a regime or like something set. Like, you know, I write every day at 9 o'clock for 3 hours, or I have like a word count goal. I don't have anything like that. I think what drives me, my discipline, is just this want to say something. Like, I'm driven by my motivation and my insecurity. Like, I think if I was completely comfortable with who I am in the world, I wouldn't work so hard to be a writer, or I wouldn't want to publish something. Like, I would just get a day job and be happy with that. But I'm not. Like, I still have issues with like self-esteem and things like that. And so, like, I'm driven by needing to feel like I have a place in the world.
You're in the position of being both a published author and a critic and reviewer, and specifically you, along with Declan Fry, have been reviewing for The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald over the past year. I spoke to another one of our podcast guests, Michael Veitch, who's both an artist and a critic, about whether being in this dual role kind of changes your approach to criticism and or gives you thicker skin. And so I wanted to ask you how you deal with positive and negative reviews of your own work and if that's changed how you publicly critique other works or not.
I try and not read any kind of comments.
At all?
Yeah.
Just like keep them away?
Well, I don't, yeah, because I'm not interested in what other people think about me.
It's so great though, because people have different approaches, right? So some people are like, have someone else read them and just like feed me through the good stuff, or some people have their agent or their publisher do it, and some people are just like flat out nothing. Some people are like, I'll take the age, but I won't take Goodreads. So it's really interesting to hear you just like flat out, nah.
I think actually that's a defense mechanism, because like part of me is like, yeah, I don't care what people who I don't know think about me. But then also I know that I'm also like really sensitive. And so maybe it's a way for me to not feel like hurt.
And so then shoe goes on the other foot and you are also a reviewer. So how does that, do you have in your head the author when you're reviewing, or is that a different, I suppose, mindset for you entirely?
I critique always the work. I don't care about the writer. So like I can be like very, very harsh on the writing, but I don't care about the writer. Like I don't care about the person who's writing. I care about the work itself.
Do you think that that is what, I know that there's a lot of conversations going on about this at the moment. Declan Fry has written some great pieces, and I know that you're in conversation with him and Sally Hepworth at Yarra Valley Writers Festival talking about this as well. Like, do you think this is something that needs to shift in the way we do the culture of criticism in arts criticism, I suppose, in Australia, or I don't know if it's wider than that?
Shift in what sense?
Shift in terms of the way that we decide to critique the work at a time when, I suppose, the publishing industry so fuses the author with the work. That's the way we are now promoted. You know, this is the author's backstory and this is their work, and it's kind of like you have to be the whole package. So at the other end then, when you're receiving criticism, it's hard, it feels hard to separate those two things, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the trend, because I don't read a lot of Australian criticism.
Yeah, right.
Maybe I shouldn't say that publicly.
No, but that's all right. You can say whatever you want.
Most of what I read is from America.
Okay.
Like, I think just saying what I've said, I realized that, you know, if I try and take into account the history of all the political identity of the actual writer, obviously. Like I'm not, like if I'm assessing a white writer or an Indigenous writer, I'm not going to ignore that fact, you know. But I guess I try and just come and meet the terms of the work on the page on its own terms.
In an interview with The Guardian, and this goes to what you just said about the political identity, you said, and I love this quote, I probably will never read another fiction book by a straight white male author, and I'm happy for you to publish that, even if that pisses people off. So I wanted to ask you about your take on the failings of the publishing industry and lit world at large in terms of representation at the moment, and if there's too many straight white males still getting published.
I'm not on the pulse in terms of how many straight white males are getting published, because I just don't even pay attention to them. I think it's like, I am very heartened by the number of women writers coming out and writing books, be it nonfiction or memoir or whatever, just be women having their perspective of the world. I don't even care what they write about. They could write about snails, but it's like just having a woman's perspective published in a book means that there are people out there, me, myself included, that value their perspective. And that's what I would want the future of the Australian publishing industry to work towards, just like valuing historically marginalized perspectives at the center, which is what I try and do, just by whom I pay attention to.
Mm. I wonder if there is a book or a story in your bottom drawer. Often writers talk about the book that they, you know, wrote first that is still down there, or one that they don't feel they can write until a certain life event has occurred. Have you got one of those books in your bottom drawer?
I actually have like three or four.
Oh my gosh. Tell me what they are, please. Tell everyone listening what you've got in your bottom drawer, please, Jessie too.
I have a book that I wrote 3 years ago when I was on a trip with my mom in France. And it's a very short book, but it's a book I can't wait to hopefully have it published one day. It's like completely finished. It's just like I haven't shown it to anyone.
Because why? Why?
Because like I have other things to say before I say that.
Okay.
Yeah, before, like as in I want to say other things to the world before that comes out. It's not as urgent. Like I feel like there are more urgent issues that I feel more kind of passionate about saying, or like there are things about the world that I disagree with more strongly than this book. Like this book about France and my mom doesn't have a strong political message, whereas like another book which I have ideas about, it's about like a group of people living in Potts Point, which is like, you know, like you can say so many things about Potts Point, but like it's just that Potts Point in Sydney is just such a brilliant location setting for like a very searing satire about Sydney wealthy white people.
Is that what's coming next?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. I mean, I have a book that's like I'm still editing it, but the next book that's coming out, that's not the next one. The Potts Point book is not the next one. But the next one I finished during the pandemic, and that's about a sex cult.
Okay, so a few things to unpack there. One, can you tell us anything more about the sex cult book?
Only in that it's also about classical musicians. I think I have this fetishizing interest in that world, maybe because I was kicked out of it or like because I left because I felt like I didn't belong. But there's something about the world of classical music that I'm really drawn to looking at. And so like, yeah, this book kind of revolves about, it's all about like a woman's perspective on that world. Like I think I will always be drawn to centering the perspective of someone who, like me, has been historically pushed aside because, you know, I have an Asian face.
Tell me, did you get messages, emails, backlash from the classical music community?
So weird. I have not. I thought I would. Like, I don't think anyone who plays in the musical world has like read my book, which is so like, I was expecting people from like, I don't know, Sydney Symphony or someone to like read my book and say, oh, this is full of shit or whatever, you know. But like nobody has, yeah, I haven't received any feedback from anyone who.
There's probably some Facebook group somewhere like classical musicians who've read Jessie Tu's book and what we think. Again, back to that point you made, you said you finished it during the pandemic. How did that go for you? Because there's been really, I've heard creatives talk about like just being completely flat. Then Tony Birch on The Garret the other day said like, oh my gosh, it was this just incredible creative period for me. And he wrote two bloody books in that time. How did you kind of manage the writing, the creativity, the editing during pandemic lockdowns, all the rest of it?
I don't have moments of creativity. I just have free moments. And then I decide whether or not I want to sit down and write it. And because I had so much time not going out because of the lockdowns during the pandemic, I mean, I think in Sydney, the worst of it was like only 2 or 3 months, maybe not even that. Yeah. And so like I used that time just to like write, and it wasn't very hard because I write every day. Like it just, like I write in my journal every day. Like writing is not a massive deal for me. You know how like people are like, oh, I bleed on the page, writing every word is excruciating. I'm like, oh, I don't, like, maybe because I don't write about, like, trauma. I understand, you know, if you're writing about real trauma, I get that. But for me, writing is, like, this way of just playing with words. And I try and keep that childish perspective on it because I know, like, I don't take myself too seriously or what I do. Like, I know I'm not saving lives. So, like, if my book bombs, if my next book bombs, like, who cares? Like, it'll be disappointing, obviously, because you want, every writer wants their book to be well-received. But at the end of the day, it's just a book. And it's like a fucking privilege for me to even have like a publisher like Alan Unwin to back me. I don't think I have any right to be sad. Like I just am so thrilled that I get to write and be like and have people read it. Like that's what a privilege that is.
If it does bomb, which I can't imagine it will, would part of that kind of recognizing the privilege of it just be like get up and do the next one? Is that what you think?
I think I will always want to keep writing. Like I hope to publish like as many books as I can in my life. Like, you know, like some people, I think Patricia Highsmith has written 30 or something crazy like that. Like I don't aim for a number, but I just aim to always have something long form on the go. Like I always hope that I have an idea for a book.
You said before about the that book about France and your mum wasn't the one that was ready to come next, that you've got this idea of what is urgent and what needs to come out. Do you kind of have a real framework for that in your head? Is that something that you feel is an important part of your practice as an artist, that you're saying the most urgent thing first?
I think so, because you want to broadcast whatever you think in a time where people will actually listen to you. So like that Potts Point book is about like the age of social media and TikTok and millennials or like Gen Z or Gen Y, whatever, like people under 30 basically or 25. And so like if I can't really write that, I feel like in 20 years time, because that would not be relevant. Like I try and come out with something that's relevant to what people are going through at that moment in time.
Before I let you go, I want to ask, is there anything that you're really, really glad that you failed at? Like where the failure set you on a new path?
Quitting law. I studied law in my 20s and I wanted to succeed so bad. Like I'm not usually a planner, but I had this whole plan. Like I was going to I was going to get the university medal and then like become a judge's associate. And then from there become like, practice as a lawyer for like 5 years and then go to the bar and then become a barrister and then from a barrister become a judge. Like I honestly wanted to be a judge. Can you believe that? Because I
at the
like,
same time as wanting to be a professional musician.
Oh no, that was after.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So my ambitions move very quickly. So like in my 20s, every kind of month I had this new ambition, but the law ambition was quite strong when I was 25, 26. And so I had this whole plan worked out. And then, like, I think in my second or third year of law school, I just had this moment where I was, like, reading a law textbook. And I don't know if you know, but, like, the law textbooks, the cases are, like, freaking tiny. Like, the text is so small. And I just, like, had this moment where my eyes were blurry and I couldn't read what was on the page. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to have to go get glasses. I don't want to get glasses. And, like, I was like, this is fucking up my eyesight. And then, like, I just realized that this is never going to end. Like, after this exam, I'm going to have to sit another exam. And then after I go to the bar, like there's always going to be something more to do as a lawyer if you want to work in the legal sector and have any kind of power or leadership position. And then that moment I realized it was never going to end. And then I had a sort of panic stress moment where I had a meltdown. And then I called my then partner and I was like, oh my God, I can't do this. And he was like, you don't have to do this. You don't have to do this. And that was like quite powerful for me to know that there are other options for me. And if I kept going with law, I would have been miserable and not like focused on what I really wanted to do, which is write my own story.
So what's the ambition now? World domination of litfic.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that every writer's dream?
I'm pretty sure it is. Pretty sure it is. Give me all the awards, but more than that, give me all the money, right?
Yeah. And like, I think there shouldn't be any hesitation in saying that as a writer, because we want money so that we can sustain our passion, which is writing. That's all I want. Like, I would love to get, like, I would love, like, the books that I sell is such a honor and a privilege, because every book gives me the chance to sustain this writing life that I want. And that's, like, every writer's dream, just to write books, I think, yeah.
I think it absolutely is. Jessie Too, it's been a delight to speak with you. I'm so looking forward to seeing you in the flesh at Warburton for Yarra Valley Writers Festival, where you will be speaking with Vic Hannon and then, as we mentioned, with Declan Fry and Sally Hepworth. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Lowlands away, my John.
Thank you, Kate. I'm Brooke Powell, Festival Director, and I'm so very pleased you joined us. This year's Yarra Valley Writers Festival is calling the township of Warburton its home over the weekend of July 16 to 18, 2021. There will be writerly sessions, walks in nature, and dinners in extraordinary rooms. We have also curated virtual sessions to be made available to those that can't make it to the beautiful Yarra Valley. We've done this as it's important to us that we stay in touch with all of you after such a strange and tumultuous time. The Yarra Valley Writers Festival thanks all of its supporters, its collaborators, and its friends that buy tickets. We need you, and we do love you. We also hope to share a long and story-filled life with all of you. With that, we pay respects to some of the greatest storytellers of all time, and we respectfully acknowledge the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri people, as the custodians of this land. We pay respect to all Aboriginal community elders, past, present and future, who have resided in the area and have been an integral part of the history of this region. If you're after tickets, more information on our program, or simply would like to send us an email, please head to our website, yarravalleywritersfestival.com.
Yarra Valley Writers Festival is funded by Creative Victoria and Yarra Rangers Tourism, supported by Yarra Rangers Council and Verso Books. The music accompanying this episode is Lowlands Away by Thomas Veitch and Rose Hampton from the Hellship soundtrack. Audio production by Phoebe Adie.